animals. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and first I want to extend humongous thanks to Bev Capshaw and Glenn Hatchell, who guest hosted Talking Animals in my absence over the last three Wednesdays. Bev on December 25th and January 1st, Glenn on January 8th. All three shows were wonderful and illuminating, dealing with rescue, fostering, shelter, adoption, training, expectations, shaping animals' behavior, and more. If you missed one or more of these shows, you should absolutely visit WNF.org, head to the Talking Animals page in the broadcast schedule, and hit Listen on Demand, selecting those dates. Meanwhile, I'm really excited to be back here at good old WNF on Talking Animals this morning. And my guest today is Dr. Marcy Follick, a veteran veterinarian and author of Little Miracles Everywhere, My Unorthodox Path to Holistic Veterinary Medicine. The book unspools into a distinctive and engaging memoir chronicling Follick's journey from conventionally trained veterinarian into a practitioner committed to a natural, holistic, drug-free approach to treating animals. This represents not only a significant transformation, of course, but also an arresting narrative and part-time travelogue, really. For example, she's a New Yorker who ventured to Italy to attend vet school, an experience brimming with colorful anecdotes and some equally colorful characters amongst her fellow students and professors. And to satisfy a growing urge for exploration of unconventional techniques, not to mention wanderlust, Dr. Follick also made a pivotal to first trek to India. There's plenty more to her story, and we'll discuss much of that story when I speak with Dr. Marcy Follick in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. By the way, she's licensed to practice in New York, Connecticut, and Florida. Coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Claudia Otis, co-founder of the Little Lion Foundation, a Long Beach organization that has offered an array of assistance to cats and their humans who have been rendered temporarily or permanently homeless and or otherwise been injured or traumatized in the wake of the LA wildfires. They've offered temporary housing, food, litter, medical care, and more. Learn more about the Little Lion Foundation, including how we can support their efforts, whether that be donations of various kinds, fostering, or helping in other ways, when I speak with Claudia Otis later in the show here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, though, let's talk with Dr. Marcy Follick and Little Miracles Everywhere, her new book charting her evolution from conventional vet to holistic one. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Marcy Follick, the Talking Animals on WMF. Good morning, Dr. Follick.
Thank you so much for having me, Duncan.
Oh, thanks for joining me this morning. I appreciate it. And first of all, congratulations on the book. It's a breezy, good read, and I learned a lot, and I was intrigued by your story.
Thank you. I loved your introduction, my wanderlust included.
Yeah, so, well, a central element of the book really involves recounting your experiences in veterinary school, so I want to spend a few minutes on that, not surprising, perhaps, starting with noting that when many of us discuss vet schools, we tend to be a bit provincial, mentioning UC Davis or Cornell or other U.S. programs, but you went to vet school in Italy. Why?
Well, what happened was, initially, I had no intention of attending veterinary school. I thought I would train horses. That was my goal. But I ended up with a degree in philosophy and literature. And after some jobs that I wasn't really pleased with, I decided to go to vet school. But I would have to go back to college and take 2 years of sciences, and I really didn't want to do that. And like you said, I had a wanderlust. When I heard about vet schools in Italy, I jumped at the chance. They did not require any pre-veterinarian, pre-medical courses, so I couldn't wait to get on the plane and go to Italy, and I'm glad I did.
And I found that interesting in the book, and again now, as you just recall it, that you had sidestepped science classes. It's one thing if people just don't feel like a kinship with science classes, whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that you could start vet school without any science classes, I find...
Well, they combine it. What happens is, in Italy, I mean, I became a vet because of my love of animals, basically. I was more of an arty type of person, so I kind of avoided science courses. But Italy combines undergraduate with veterinary school. So they have it together. So it's not like we do learn basic science courses, but it's a five-year program that combines everything together.
Yeah, that's great. So that's kind of what took you there. What are some ways you're aware of that vet school in Italy, other than getting started, as we've just acknowledged, differs from U.S. programs?
Well, you know what? This was 40 years ago. 1976, I started that school. So it was very different. Now I think they're very, very similar. But at that time, the reason it was open enrollment, they were the 60s revolutions, and the populace felt it wasn't fair that only the rich elite could go to vet school, so they made vet school and all colleges free. So it was like an attrition rate that they let everybody in, but about 80% flunked out in the meantime. So at that time, actually, it was all in Italian. That's number one. I had to learn Italian, which was a feat in itself. So.
Yeah, let's not leave that out, because that, to me, that's kind of a huge element of going to vet school. Yeah. I mean, as if vet school isn't difficult enough, like you're doing it in not at your foreign tongue and you have to learn that language.
I would sit there for like an hour with one page, the book in English, the book in Italian, an English-Italian dictionary, an English medical dictionary. It took me a whole day to translate one page. So I went to classes, but I couldn't understand a word. So I ended up coming back to America after my first year there and studying the basic courses at a community college, which really helped me get the base. But it was difficult. But besides, the Italian wasn't the hard part. What was really hard was the exams were oral. So basically, there was no quizzes, no little tests. You had to study on your own, basically, let's say physiology, which is a huge course. And after you study physiology, like a year later or something like that, you go and sit in front of the professor and all the students, and they ask you three questions. If you don't answer the three questions perfectly, you're thrown out of the class, and you have to come back and take the exam again. So how it's different also, they get exams once a month. I mean, it's a crazy system. And finally, they get sick of seeing you, I guess, and they pass you. But it's a lot of 51 exams I had to go through. And as I say, 80% of the people flunked out. I got through it, but it did take me 10 years to get through.
Well,
and then when I came back, sorry, I got that.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, those exams, as you recounted in the book, like you just mentioned now, it's three questions, but I mean, they could be any three questions. So, yeah. I mean, you have to like have such a deep knowledge of anything, because if something is like you kind of vaguely recall it and you don't quite get that question number two right, you're out.
So what's funny is, I mean, that's the way we feel as Americans. So I studied, that's why it took me so long. I studied everything, memorized everything. The way the Italians at that time learned it is that they just figured, well, what the heck, it's given once a month. You ask three questions, you study three things. You go in every month, and finally they get sick of seeing you and they pass you. But let me say how it's different from American vet school. When I came back, when I graduated in 86, I had to learn the whole American system by myself. So I spent a year or so learning the entire American program, which was very different. We were taught more theoretical stuff. In America, it's more practical. So I had to learn more hands-on stuff. I had to learn the whole American way, which I did on my own. And it's one of many, many miracles in my book, the fact that I passed it the first time, which nobody from Italy had ever done. So God helped me through that hurdle.
Well, by then, you were probably so ready and steeped and maybe more prepared than you even figured to be based on the training you got there.
I'm a perfectionist, I'm a perfectionist. So I always think I don't know enough, but I guess I did. So thankfully, I did pass, and I am a practicing vet for now 4 years.
Yeah. So that's, I guess, why vet school sort of, for you and others, became sort of a protracted stint, really. And I guess one of the things I think you know in your book also, as many of your fellow students found it really rough going. I mean, a sizable number, I think, did not graduate. Was that just because it was ultra rigorous, or other factors beyond the ones you've already mentioned?
It's a kind of do-it-yourself program. I mean, in America, when I came back to the community college here in the States, it was so easy. I mean, they cut small classes, and we had hundreds of people in a class. And there's no room for questions and answers. There's no hands-on. So in America, although it may be hard to get into schools, you're coddled once you get in. In Italy, you know, particularly in a foreign country where you know no one, you don't know the language, and you're kind of at sea. You have to figure out the system. You have to navigate learning the three questions. And it's very hard to have the discipline to do everything on your own. And I do have self-discipline, and I learned more by being there. It's really given me good schools for life. That's what helped me actually helped me to get on the holistic path. What I've seen, as I say in my book, is that veterinarians that have trained in Italy tend to be more open-minded than the Americans trained in American vet schools. We have to think outside of the box in order to succeed. And we are not, like, kind of, what's the word, given, follow the rules. We don't always have to follow the rules. We have to think about how to get things done.
Yeah. Well, before we go too much further, do you, I mean, because there was certainly some amusing, I thought, colorful anecdotes in the book about taking certain exams or preparing for certain exams or just certain professions. Anything that you want to particularly cite in that way before we...
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I guess the funniest one was my last. So there are 51 exams. Some professors are very tough. Like my physiology exam was the first exam that I had failed because he asked me an unknown. They always get three questions. Physiology was considered the hardest. I knew everything. I answered three questions perfectly. And because I was so perfect and because there's a bit of ego in the professors, they want to show how much they know and how little you know. He asked me a fourth unheard of question, which is the EKG, which nobody, he never asked. And I couldn't find anything about it. I flunked out of that, but that actually taught me, it was the first exam I ever failed in my life. It taught me not to be afraid of failure. On the other end of the spectrum, my last exam was on fish. And some professors are just really nice. They just want to help you get through. So my last exam was fish, and I studied all the different types of fish, where their fins were, where their eyes were, what kind of water they swam in, and I was really nervous. And the professor, when I sat down for the exam, he says, "Señorina, why are you so nervous?" I said, "Because this is my last exam." He says, "Don't worry, don't worry." So then he asked me, "How do you prepare fish in your country?" And I looked at him like, what kind of question is that? And he says, like, you know, if you make shrimp, how do you prepare that? And I was a vegetarian at the time. And I said, "Shrimp scampi." And he said, "You passed." And that was my last exam. So it's it's a crazy system. Either they're trying to fail you or they just want you to be happy.
Yeah, you just don't know which version you're getting, I guess, when you walk into that day's exam.
It's so crazy. Yeah, crazy system. But it's now much more like America. So that was in the 70s.
Yeah.
But it taught me a lot. It taught me to depend on myself, to trust myself, to not be afraid. So it served me greatly in my line of work.
Yeah, no, for sure. It sounds like it was... you know, trying at times to say the least, but you're all the better for it, and probably all the better of a veterinarian for all the experiences cumulatively that you went through to get there.
Made me strong.
There you go. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Marcy Falick, a veteran veterinarian and author of the new memoir, Little Miracles Everywhere, My Unorthodox Path to Holistic Veterinary Medicine. If you have questions for Dr. Falick or would like to offer a comment about holistic veterinary medicine or aspects or conventional veterinary medicine, I guess for that matter, vaccinations, acupuncture, something else that comes to mind, please call 813-239-9663 or you can email dj@wmf.org or text 813-433-0885. So one aspect of the book that's significant in many ways is your first of many, it later turns out, but your first trip to India. So can you kind of describe what attracted you about traveling in India and how that first trip did influence you?
Yeah, so I see my book also as a spiritual book. I come from a dysfunctional family, and I didn't have a very happy childhood, and I was always searching for God. And I started, my roommate in college gave me the book Siddhartha. This is in the 1970s, and it started me on a whole alternative path of spirituality, and it really intrigued me. I ended up reading the book, The Autobiography of the Yogi by Yogananda, and basically it talked about all these miracles in India. I was always attracted to India. I don't have no idea why, maybe a past life, but I knew I would get there when the time was right. And as I recount in the book, at a certain point, I'd been there 4 years. It's a 5-year program. I think I'd done 18 exams at that point. I had 38 to go or something like that. And I just felt I needed some help from God. So I went off to India with a group of Italians, and it blew my mind what I saw there. I mean, it was...
How so?
Well, first of all, at that time in 1980, it was like 5 minutes from the Bible. I mean, people, it looked like it was 2,000 years ago with, you know, goat herds. There was nothing there. It was like desert. And I had heard about all these miracles that were this person, Sai Baba, or this being, Sai Baba, whose ashram I went to, performed. Supposedly he materialized things from thin air. He knew your past, present, and future. He raised people from the dead. He multiplied food. And all the things they attribute to Jesus, Baba supposedly did. And I went to India an agnostic, but I always had an open mind. And I saw things like I met a girl that had been dead for 3 days, they said, and she was revived from the dead. I met her. I saw Sai Baba materialize things at the ashram and later materialized actually in my house here in Fairfield County. And it's hard to wrap your head around seeing these so-called miracles. And one miracle after another, not only at the ashram, but in my life, as I talk about in the book, after 20 years, finally, I am convinced there is a God. And what I want in my book to talk about, to impart to others also, is that we are all part of the divine. We are all connected to a greater source. And if we can learn to tune into that inner voice, the small voice within, I think as it says in the Bible, it will lead us in the right direction. It will give us our path in life. It will always lead us to the right answer to whatever question we have. And that is what I have learned throughout the past 40 years, 50 years almost.
Yeah, well, that's why in some ways the title is Little Miracles, but sometimes I think maybe it should be Bigger Miracles or Big Miracles.
Well, sometimes, there, you know, little things happen when you look at the big miracles, but we don't really give recognition to the little things that happen. When you, like, I think it was Kierkegaard said that life could only be lived forward, but it could only be understood backward. When we look at things that happened in our life that would maybe seem like a tragedy, a disaster, we can see if it weren't for that, we wouldn't be where we are today. And that has been another miracle in my writing the book, to put my life in perspective, because I had a lot of downs, you know, difficulties. Mm-hmm. But looking at the overall, I am so grateful for everything, because I would never be in the position I am today if it weren't for those tragedies that happened in my life.
And how many trips subsequently have you made to India?
I've made about a dozen trips to India.
Yeah. So your book functions as many things. One of those is, once you became a full-fledged veterinarian, after this sort of long winding path you described, a collection of sort of disheartening discoveries you made, that a number of veterinarians you worked with seem to be driven more by dollars than a genuine desire to heal animals. Can you talk about your first experiences being bothered in that regard?
Well, I first say, I think that things are, I don't know. I haven't been in the conventional veterinary world for about 30 years. At that time, it was mostly male, and getting into vet school in America is very, very difficult. But it seems that a lot of the vets at that time really wanted to be doctors, but they didn't want to go through all the, you know, years of postgraduate training.
Wanted to be MDs as opposed to vets, you mean?
Yeah, but they didn't want to deal with liability and post. I just didn't see the love of the animals the way that I felt it.
Yeah.
I was a vegetarian, not that anybody had to be a vegetarian, but they really didn't understand that I didn't want to eat my patients. But, you know, just the way they would, as I say in the book, the way they would do autopsies and laugh and cut in front of the hospitalized sick animals. I mean, I understood that those animals can smell the fear, can see, they can understand what's going on. And I would tell my bosses to please don't laugh and please don't do this in front of the sick animals. I mean, I saw a lot, you know, things that were done that were needless, invasive procedures or unnecessary vaccines given too often that they knew they didn't have to give, but, you know, they wanted to make the income. And I just never was that way. To me, it was always about truth and about helping the animals. And so I could never compromise my integrity by putting profits above love of animals. Unfortunately, that's what I saw most of the time.
Yeah. And looking back, when did you start seriously questioning the tenets of practicing conventional veterinary medicine? Was there like a light bulb moment, or was this more of a gradual process of it dawning on you in that way?
Well, it's kind of funny. One of the reasons I didn't want to go and become a vet is that I was already skeptical of drugs. Since I had been a vegetarian in 1970, I was very aware of health. I didn't like to take aspirin. I didn't like to take anything. And so I'm just taking a sip of the water. So I was skeptical of drugs. When I became a vet, I really hated surgery. I was always afraid I was going to kill the animal, which I never did in surgery, but it was too stressful for me. But what happened was, so I really felt like a square peg in a round hole. I didn't fit in. But when my own dog developed a ruptured cruciate ligament, And they didn't know at this time that's what it was. That's what I thought it was. They wanted me to put her on non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. I just didn't trust. I didn't want to go that route. And I had heard of a veterinary acupuncturist in the area, and I decided to try that before I went the drug and surgery route. It just felt better to me. I didn't want to do anything invasive or use drugs. And as it happened, the acupuncture did not help her, but while I was sitting in the waiting room with the acupuncturist, I saw these animals were like being lured. I saw these animals that were paralyzed that now walk, animals that were on drugs that now are off drugs and doing great. And after taking my dog there for 8 weeks, I decided to pursue a certification course in acupuncture. And that just changed my life. I saw so many, you know, hopeless cases that I could heal. And I just knew this was more my path. I felt kind of like a conduit of miraculous healing from God rather than just a dispenser of drugs. Drugs always come with potential side effects. And so, you know, you look enough to watch TV and you see this drug is great and then all the list of side effects that come after that. So I just didn't want to put my dog through that. What happens is when you're a new vet, I was working 7 days a week, 100 hours a week. I mean, you don't have time to explore many things.
Yeah.
So it took my dog getting really sick that she almost died for me. That was afterwards. But it took my dog to push me to do the acupuncture course. I mean, I was working 100 hours a week. To do the acupuncture, I was studying from 8 till 12 at night. I almost killed myself working so hard.
Yeah.
I would do anything for my baby. And then when I saw the results, I knew I was on the right path. I just felt this was where I should be. This is what God wants me to do. So instead of feeling like a square peg in a round hole, I knew I was in absolutely the right place. And that was 30 years ago, and there's no looking back.
For sure. Well, again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is veterinarian Dr. Marcy Falick, author of the new memoir, Little Miracles Everywhere, My Unorthodox Path to Holistic Veterinary Medicine. You're invited to join this conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at WNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So as part of this kind of shift and starting to see the virtues of acupuncture, what were the first conditions or ailments you observed being mitigated by acupuncture?
Well, our teacher said, and it's true, that paralysis would be our bread and butter. So herniated discs, and anybody that's had a bad back knows how painful that is.
Yeah.
I would say I've had a 95 to 99% success in treated paralysis and herniated discs. I mean, one of my miraculous cases there was a dog, Phoebe, that was hit by a car and broke its back. I mean, I really didn't think I was going to be able to help her, but the dog had like a complete fracture. It was like a layer cake, one vertebrae above the other. She was shrieking in pain, couldn't move, couldn't pee, couldn't wag her tail, and she was destined for euthanasia. But the owner, who was an 80-year-old psychologist, used the same acupuncturist that I did. And after the board certified specialist told him, you know, there was really no hope, you better put Phoebe to sleep, he asked me if I could help the dog. I said, listen, I don't know, but let's give it a try. And after 6 weeks, the dog was as good as new. So, I mean, what happened was, I used acupuncture for just about everything. I used it for Cushing's disease. I used it for skin disease. I used it for autoimmune disease. But when I wanted to expand my repertoire, I learned about a certification course in homeopathy for veterinarians, and I decided, through one miracle and another, as you know from my book, to take that course. And that really changed everything. As good as acupuncture is, there was still conditions like cancer and emotional problems that couldn't be addressed. And with acupuncture, you still needed to use some pharmaceuticals. What I found with my 30 years with homeopathy is that if I use an antibiotic once in a year, that's a lot. 70% of what I treat now is cancer, and probably 30%, the most of the rest is allergies, which also acupuncture doesn't help very well. And the success rate, as people can tell from the testimonials on my website, I usually get 2 to 3 years, more 3 years past where they should be dead with cancer. And my best is even preventative care. What I want to see is, I call myself the 11th hour vet. I don't want to be the 11th hour vet. What I want to do is to have people come to me or another holistic vet early to prevent the cancer.
Yeah.
So that they can live like they use dogs. When I started practicing 40 years ago, dogs lived into the mid-20s. I mean, I had a dog 27 years old, not my dog, a client's
wow.
dog. But it was not unusual to have dogs 21, 22 years old. And cats lived into the mid-20s easily. Now at 8 years old, vets are telling people their dog is sick. And it's not. It's all because of the pharmaceutical industry, to be honest with you. We pour too much of that stuff into our people and animals. And so if we learn to use holistic modalities and prevent using certain drugs and things, they should live longer, much longer. So I adopt dogs. I always rescue my dogs. They come to me sick, and they're big dogs. They're usually between 60 and 85 pounds, and they live till 16.
Wow. Well, I want to come back to that in a sec, but one thing you mentioned, too, that I was going to ask about a moment ago was, I think we kind of touched on, you know, observing some of your fellow vets that sort of weren't just emphasizing dollars over good care, although there was that, but were providing care that you started to realize because of the drugs, et cetera, was sort of counterproductive. So, so much for do no harm, I guess. So, it sounds like, but from what you're talking about, how many cancer patients you get, are you sort of there's word out that like you're sort of the vet that when someone gets a cancer diagnosis to go see Dr. Fallon?
Well, you know what happens is that Western medicine is limited. At a certain point, when they either can't afford the $30,000 to $50,000 bill that they have to pay for the chemo, radiation, and surgery, and that's literally what it is around the New York area, or their vet says it's hopeless, it's inoperable, then they search out alternative care. So I, in the beginning, I would ask people, oh, when did you get into holistic medicine? They look at me like I'm crazy. They said, I'm not into holistic medicine. I want anything I can to help my animal. So that's when they think of it, when there's no hope in general. I mean, things maybe a little bit are shifting now. They're learning to, it's more common to have some holistic practices, and people are becoming a little more skeptical of conventional care. But basically, people want to help their pets. And, you know, it's when they're at the end of the line that they think of holistic, which that's what I hope to change in my book. I really want people, I don't want to see cancer. I don't want to see cancer with anybody. I don't want to treat cancer. I want to keep the animals healthy and happy without having to come to me. And I look for another job. If there's nobody sick, that's fine with me.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to come back to, there's an email I'd like to incorporate, but there's also a phone call I'd like to get involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Fallock.
Hi, good morning. This is Howard in Clearwater. How are you doing?
Hi, Howard.
Yeah. Hey, quick question. Vaccines are always an issue for humans and animals. And I'm fairly hesitant to give my dog all the vaccines that are recommended. Are there any recommended vaccines that your guests would say is acceptable or not?
Howard, you stole one of my next section of questioning, but let's get to it now because that was obviously inevitable, so this is as good a time as any.
I'm glad you asked that, actually. Yeah. First of all, let me say we are over-vaccinating completely all the time. No vaccine is safe, and no vaccine is 100% effective. If you're going to vaccinate at all, you want to stick to only the vaccines where you are at risk. So typically, I recommend just the distemper and parvo components. I'm not the 5-in-1 or 6-in-1, just those two parts of the vaccine. If that is given at 4 months old, that typically lasts the lifetime of the animal. Parvo is a disease only of puppies, so it's rarely, if ever, seen in adult dogs. And again, one vaccine at 4 months old lasts a lifetime. The only other vaccine that is mandated by law, which is different in every state, only Hawaii doesn't require it, is the rabies.
Yeah.
That vaccine actually does last for at least 10 years, it seems. The reason that they are labeled 1 and 3 years, which is the same vaccine, the reason they're labeled good only for 1 or 3 years is because they euthanize, they test the dogs, they give it the vaccine, they test it at 1 or 3 years, then they euthanize it. But they do, unfortunately, they do not want to test them longer than that. Dr. Gene Dodds, who's in my book, who's a top veterinary immunologist in the world probably, she's been fighting with them to get them to test it for longer. But basically, you know, they don't need it every 3 years even, but that's the law. But other than that, I would do nothing.
Howard, does that help you? Does that give you the info you were looking for?
Perfectly, absolutely. And thank you for your show. It's been terrific listening to you, and I'll get your book. It sounds like it's going to be wonderful.
Absolutely.
Okay,
all right,
so
thanks for your call. So just to kind of continue on that thread a little bit more, Dr. Fallock. So basically the ones you mentioned, that's it. So back to rabies, by the way, the initial rabies, but are there too many boosters and other follow-up vaccinations in that regard?
God. I mean, well, you know, just let me talk about leptospirosis, for example. Leptospirosis is a zoonotic disease, meaning it can be transferred from animals to people.
Yeah.
And this is a vaccine that has the worst reaction. Even in my conventional practices, we would see that they'd have the worst reactions to lepto, and we'd eliminate that from the 5 or 6-in-1. It's such a rare disease that even the CDC, it's not reportable. There's only 100 to 200 cases in the country per year. In New York, where they push it, they say you can't go nose to nose. You can get it from from rest, and it's so important. I looked up the statistics. You have a 0.00003% of getting rabies in the whole, you know, queen of the five boroughs here. It's so rare. Mm. And actually, the testing to see if it's misdiagnosed all the time. They say it's lepto, but it's not. There's only one test, which I believe the CDC does, that nobody else does, that can really see if it's positive or not. So they just, you know, misdiagnose it and say it's lepto. But lepto can also give the vet lepto. What happens when you give a vaccine, you're introducing either the live, dead, or virus, or Bacterin, and you're actually giving the energy of the disease into the body. So oftentimes you create the symptom, for example, rabies. A lot of dogs are very aggressive. I've seen it. Dogs come to me, I give them a rabies shot, and then they switch. They become aggressive. I had a pit bull that was the sweetest dog in the world. They adopted it. It had no vaccines. It was from the streets. I gave it a rabies shot, and it ended up biting off the owner's lip. I'm going to have to euthanize it. It attacked the grandmother. It was terrible.
Sorry, I'm just very, very interested in this part of the story and just want to make sure I understand. So you gave that dog the rabies vaccine because you were required to?
Yes.
Yeah, because otherwise it sounds like you wouldn't necessarily do that in that space.
I would want to. I have to, you know, there are homeopaths. This was one of the worst cases that I've seen.
Yeah.
I mean, there are. I treat vaccine injury. So when I say I treat cancer and I treat this and I treat that, I say 70% of what I treat is vaccine injury. And rabies is one of the worst vaccines, actually. It gives seizures. It's a neurological disease. So it hits the spinal cord and the brain. You have encephalitis. You have tumors and this and that. And I would say most of the time I'm able to treat it with homeopathy. This particular, when it's an aggression problem with a pit bull, I was able to mitigate the symptoms, but this dog became too dangerous, and we had to euthanize it. So this is just an example.
Yeah.
And what I just learned, actually, which is shocking to me, I was recently at the Cornell Continuing Education. It seems that there's been no canine strain of rabies in the U.S. for 14 years. There's a feline strain. There's all different kind of strains. But this is from the experts of the Rabies Center in New York, I believe it is. There's been no canine strain of rabies for 14 years in America. So we're killing all these dogs or maiming all these dogs for no particular reason.
Because there's a legal requirement to provide them those vaccinations.
Yep. So it's all, in my opinion, I do think some vaccine, what I did hear, I'm not sure because I'm not a virologist, I'm not a research person, that the vaccine, it's not 100% effective at all. And rabies, you don't always get rabies, even if you're bit by a rabid animal, and it's 50% treatable. I don't know any of this stuff. But if you live in an area or you have an indoor cat, if you have an indoor or a little shih tzu that is walking in cement in New York on the 45th floor, why does it need a rabies shot? You know, I mean, it's really risk versus benefit. So I do believe that the distemper and parvo shots can prevent it, although they cause all kinds of problems. I just did vaccinate my two kittens for their distemper shot, which is a feline distemper. One developed asthma. The other developed inflammatory bowel disease within a couple of weeks. I did treat them homeopathically. They are okay. And I'm kind of sad that I did this. They are indoor Persian cats, and they didn't really need it. But, you know, it's all a learning process. I mean, we're all learning about the dangers and risks. I mean, in India, I did do fundraisers in order to vaccinate the stray dogs in India with distemper. It's a terrible disease, and they don't believe in euthanasia there. It's transmittable, and they were I'm speaking Italian now. They were shelters where they would keep the homeless dogs with distemper, and one after another would die a terrible death. So I would vaccinate them just for distemper, and they seemed to be okay. I did have one shepherd, though. A guy came to me. His dog had died from vaccines. He was my trainer. He came to me with a German Shepherd puppy. So this is really important. I had read this years ago, and I believe this is in my book, a compendium article about degenerative myelopathy, which is MS for dogs. It's, you know, as people may know, in shepherds, they get this paralysis and they euthanize.
Yeah.
So they isolated the distemper antigen from the vaccine in these dogs. The only way to diagnose this is an autopsy. So anyway, this is one of the worst cases I've seen. He brought the puppy to me, a shepherd, I gave him the first parvo, no reaction at all. And then I had him come back 2 weeks later for the distemper. Within a week, the dog went paralyzed. It was from the distemper shot, and he had to euthanize it. So there's always risk. There's always risk. I mean, so it's very frightening. That was the worst. And generally, it's not so bad, but he wasn't a happy guy. And I felt sick about that also.
So, Dr. Pavlik, let me ask you this, because one of the things that you chronicle in the book is that when you're first working with various vets and just kind of trying to get started and get a job and get some experience and pay your bills,
yep,
et cetera,
yep,
you have encounters with people that are obviously much more traditional vets than mm-hmm. certainly than you became. And mm-hmm. do you find now with some of the things you've said in the book or just that you might say on a show like this that you're considered like kind of a bit of a rogue individual or
totally. I mean, as you can see from my book, they were not happy when I had success where they failed.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's partly ego. It's horrible. I'm not a full-scale hospital. I just do holistic. I want to work with conventional vets. Sometimes you do need surgery. Sometimes you need an ultrasound. I want vets that are open. They are not open. They are generally very resistant. I mean, my father was a furrier, and I would sign petitions not to kill animals for fur as a vegetarian. And he would not admit until his deathbed that he was doing something wrong. So they have a lot invested in terms of ego. They don't want to admit that they're harming animals.
Sure.
So there's a bit of ego. And then, you know, I don't make the kind of money. I mean, these guys are making, now with the chemo industry, they're making a fortune. I mean, I've been working very hard, as you know from my book, and I'm still working hard. I'm now working 6 days a week, not seven, just to pay my bills. But again, I would not compromise myself. But they're making millions. I mean, I get maybe $800 for a cancer case. They're making $30,000, $50,000.
Yeah. I think that's what sort of is clear. Sometimes you imply it, sometimes it's more explicit. But that's what's driving them in the way that they handle their practices, really.
Yep. I mean, it's a whole... I mean, vet school now is so expensive also.
Right, they're paying off their loans.
But you know what? I think that most vets went into it for the right reason, to help animals. But as you saw from my book, when I showed them the evidence of what they were doing, of vaccine injury, of all these things, they just turned on their heels. And this was before the chemo industry came about. I mean, how can you live with yourself? I mean, it's just so... So when I found my homeopathic colleagues, we all work really hard. We're committed. We're a small group of, a few hundred people around the world, maybe, that do this. But yeah. I finally found my birds of a feather, because I would rather clean houses, nothing wrong with cleaning houses, than kill animals. There's no way I could live with myself. And, you know, we need to educate. I'm happy for this opportunity to speak to have a wider audience, because the pushback has got to come from the people. You know, from the clients. I mean, we're so brainwashed and indoctrinated to believe that everything is safe and effective and everything's good, that we have to start listening to our inner voices, as I said in the beginning. Because so many times I've had clients come here and their pet is injured, vaccine injured, drug injured, like the flea products. Those are just as bad as the vaccines.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, I knew something. I knew I shouldn't have done it. I should have learned, listen to myself. We're so trained to believe the man in white, the woman in white, as am I with other kind of people. We have to learn to trust ourselves. And I can't treat everybody. And I just want people to listen to themselves, to get to the trusted sources, to maybe go, if there's not a holistic vet around, there's a naturopath for people that will give them some information. But it's a whole system. We've got to shift the system. So I'm really, really grateful to you, Duncan, for giving me this opportunity to speak about this, because it is very controversial. But everybody loves their animals, no matter what side of the fence
they're on
with anything. They want their animals to have long, healthy lives.
Right. Well, we are sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. Pavlik, but I wanted to ask you just quickly. So your practice, basically, you see patients directly, and it sounds like there's somewhere there's some either video conference or telephone consultation that goes on?
Yeah. So I do have on my website, I do the phone consults. So I am thinking actually of starting, because as I say, I can't treat everybody.
Right.
I see a new client, I spend 2 hours or plus with them. But I'm looking into starting a kind of a concierge business to help people navigate, like this man's question, to navigate the conventional system if they can't have a holistic vet with them. Because people need a trusted source, and I really have no horse in the race here. I just want to help the animals. And I wish I could encourage more vets. I'm going to start crying here. I wish I could encourage more young veterinarians to go into this, but there was a guy that I treated his dog. He's local. Dog did great, and I said he was 38 years old. I said, you know, you should go into this. He says, you make work too hard for too little money. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
So, so I want to help people as best as I can. So I'm hoping through like that kind of, not necessarily treating all of them, but in helping them to navigate in a safe way the conventional system, or to find a holistic ways simply to help their animals. Because the way that I work is very, very time intensive. People can work out, reach out to me via my email is the best way to get me at this point.
Right, and we'll just say that the
website is holisticvets.us.
Right.
Holisticvets.us.
We're just about at the end of our time here, but I'm going to come to an email I alluded to earlier that kind of deals more with the sort of some of the spirituality that you discussed earlier in the interview. And this emailer says, how do you understand and incorporate your spiritual learning into animals that are abused? I'm having a very hard time processing animal abuse stories I hear. We only have like a minute or less, probably. I'm sorry at this point.
Yeah, no, I don't have to deal with that. I had to deal with that when I was a conventional vet.
Yeah.
But I have the 1%, I call them. These are the people that don't necessarily have the money, but they would do anything for their animals. It is heartbreaking. I'm right there with you. I can't deal with it. It's horrible. But fortunately, that's not part of my my world right now. I'm just dealing with sick and dying animals, not from medical abuse, not from people abuse.
I got you. All right, so I think this is kind of the end of our time here together, Dr. Falik. So this has been Dr. Marcy Falik. Her book is Little Miracles Everywhere, My Unorthodox Path to Holistic Veterinary Medicine. The website is holisticvet.us to find out more or get in touch with her or pursue other things that you want that we touched on in this interview. So, Dr. Falik, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. I really appreciate it, and I acknowledge I really enjoyed the book.
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity, Duncan.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye.
In a moment, I'll speak with Claudia Otis, co-founder of the Little Lion Foundation. The Long Beach, California organization has offered an array of assistance to cats and their humans affected by the L.A. wildfires. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a longtime fave, Brian Regan, and a piece somewhat relevant to our conversation with Dr. Falik. Here's Brian Regan with a piece called Doctors and Veterinarians in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My doctor looked at me and said, Brian, you are way too sedentary. So I vowed in that moment to get a dictionary. But I haven't gotten around to it, I've just been laying around a house. Or is it lying around a house? Doctors specialize, right? Last month, I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. Last week, I went to an arch of the foot, small of the back, nape of the neck doctor. I have fallen arches, my small's too big, and I have a trick nape. It's weird. In the human world, there's a doctor for every body part, but in the animal world, a veterinarian takes care of all animals and all their parts? It's got to be the hardest job in the world. Where are the bighorn sheep knee doctors? The wildebeest gastroenterologists? The giraffe throat, and throat doctors?
Okay, it's Talking Animals on WNF. A little trouble there reaching our next guest, but we have her now. That was Brian Regan in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Doctors and Veterinarians, taken from his Netflix special On the Rocks. Now it's time to talk with Claudia Otis of the Little Lion Foundation about the ways they're helping cats and their families affected by the L.A. wildfires and how we might help them provide that kind of help. So here's Claudia Otis on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Claudia.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Yes.
So you're based in Long Beach, which I think means you're not directly at risk from the fires, but close enough to help those who've been displaced by the fires or otherwise affected by them.
Yes. We're about 30 miles away from the Palisades fire, so we're definitely not right in the line of it, but we are here.
Closer than you'd like, yeah, for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So the fires have surely altered your day-to-day priorities. But let me ask you to sort of briefly describe your mission under more conventional circumstances at the Little Lion Foundation, and then we'll get into some of the work with the people that have been affected by the fires.
Sure. So the Little Lion Foundation opened specifically to help our local municipal shelters with neonatal kittens. Here in Southern California, we have so many kittens born on the streets entering our shelters, and we're just we are here to try to help the no-kill movement per se, so that little tiny babies aren't euthanized due to lack of resources.
So under normal circumstances, that's kind of the focus of the work of the Little Lion Foundation.
Yes, that's our mission.
Right. Okay, so tell me what kinds of assistance the foundation has provided to various folks impacted by the fires, starting with those who had to evacuate.
So we are offering, we've cleared our facility. We have space for about 30 cats here. When the fires started, we cleared our facility, put all our existing cats into foster homes. We rallied, and we have a lot of open foster homes. The only problem right now is that we're having a very hard time getting a hold of any of the cats because no one has been allowed back into the fire zone. So we have only taken in a handful, which are people that either were evacuated or cats that we cleared from local shelters to make room for medical cats. We're collecting donations that we'll be taking a bunch over to one of the supply sites, the open supply areas for pets. Probably today we'll be taking a load up. Yeah, we've been told to brace ourselves because as soon as they get into those areas, there will be a lot of cats in need.
So it sounds like you're equipped to do a lot more than you currently are, but just circumstantially, you're sort of prevented because people don't have direct access to their homes and the cats that may need your help.
Yes. We actually went up past the Palisades fire zone last night and picked up a cat that was evacuated and left at a veterinarian's office that actually, he came in severely dehydrated and they hydrated him and got him feeling a little better over the last 2 days. So we took him in. We're holding him, you know. So many animals are going to be displaced into so many different areas that it's going to be really hard for people to actually find their pets. So
Wow. We
are going to be a holding zone for as long as we need to in the hopes that people can be reunited.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was going to talk to you about that because I think cats often have difficulty being yanked out of their day-to-day routine. As it is, they become particularly attached to their homes and where they nap and eat and et cetera. So I would think evacuated cats in that regard probably find it super upsetting and traumatic to be displaced, evacuated, moved somewhere else. So how do you and your colleagues try to help mitigate those reactions?
So our team is really good at dealing with those kind of cats. Cats in general are just scared when they're moved out of their, you know, their home base. That's why you see them often in shelters. They're labeled as, you know, feral or be cautious. But they end up being wonderful cats because they're just scared. So a lot of we're all volunteer ran, and all of our volunteers just adore cats. And I think we all have a really good way of just giving them their space and their time. To, you know, just come around. And they almost always do unless they generally are feral. But even with them, we know how to work with feral cats too.
Yeah. So with the cats that have been able to be rescued from the fires and the ones that will be soon, it sounds like, what kind of thing is the Little Lion Foundation able to provide to those cats and or their humans?
So we have access to medical care. We have an on-site veterinarian that will come every day. We can offer free medical. We offer, you know, unlimited time for housing the cats.
Yeah,
we're prepared to just hold on to them until they find their owners. We have a lot of fosters that want to give these cats, you know, a loving home environment to land. just so that they can get through this.
Yeah.
It's going to be a long recovery process. And when it comes to the animals, I think it's going to be even longer for them because their owners are, you know, they don't have homes right now. So
for sure. Super complicated.
It is very complicated, and we're prepared to just hold on to them. You know, just hold them until they can be reunited, hopefully.
Yeah. So we're nearing the end of our time here, Claudia, but just very quickly, let's talk about how people listening can help with whatever kind of donations. So would that be money, cat food, litter, and what's the best place way to get things to you guys? Is it through littlelionfoundation.org is your website, or through socials,
yes,
or what do you recommend?
Probably our website would be best. We have a mailing address on there. We have a Amazon wish list.
Okay.
Donations. You know, everything is on our website.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and then you can follow any of the cats that we take in or how we're helping on our social media.
Okay, great. So that's what people will do. We'll go to littlelionfoundation.org. We're out of time at this point. I'm sorry, Claudia, but thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much.
It's WMNF Tampa.